Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and welcome back one of our regular co-hosts, Laurel Sisler. Welcome, Laurel.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking soon with Dr. Nathaniel Morris, a resident psychiatrist at Stanford University Medical School, about new narratives in the field of mental health. He's written some really interesting articles about the need to really reconsider, does psychiatry move in the realm only of diseases that you can't really pinpoint, or what's it about?
Good discussion. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. But first, we've got some interesting research that matters. I think things that are sometimes life-changing, sometimes silly. We'll see. Let's talk about our very first one that I think is kind of a life-changing one, which is about exercise and drugs and counseling for those who are fatigued undergoing cancer treatment.
Yeah. So it was a meta-analysis of 113 studies looking at over 11,000 cancer patients with fatigue. And so there were different treatment options. So exercise was one, psychotherapy, both exercise and psychotherapy, or drugs. And they found that actually exercise and psychotherapy together combined had a 26 to 30% reduction in fatigue during and after cancer treatment, compared with only a 9% decline in fatigue when drugs were used. So that's a pretty, seems like to me, pretty significant difference.
Yeah, I see a lot of my patients have cancer, and I think about, oh, they have depression, which one might expect undergoing cancer treatment. You want to treat it, and oh, it's so easy to say, let's just put you on that Prozac.
Yeah.
But the reality is they're going to do better if I just recommend let's work on some cognitive behavioral therapy and get you in to see a therapist. And here's a small exercise regimen here. And by the way, it's three times better outcome than the drug.
And very little risk, if any at all. So whereas, you know, drugs do have their side effects too. It makes me think of just a very common strategy for treatment of depression, which is just like behavioral activation, which is a fancy word for just kind of getting out and doing things. And it makes a lot of sense to me from a mental health perspective.
Yeah, this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal Oncology. And it was kind of a robust study. So they really did account for lots of different things. And there are some limitations that doesn't apply necessarily to each and every person. But it certainly suggests there's a huge role for the studies that they're talking about to consider exercise and behavioral treatment instead of immediately going to drugs. Speaking of things for us to think about, let's talk about our next research that mattered. It has to do with diet, the good foods and the bad foods as they relate to dietary issues and bad health, or what kills hundreds of thousands of people a year.
Yeah, and this one you could get kind of whiplash trying to figure out, going back and forth between are fats bad, are they good, and really get confused with it. But I feel pretty confident that there's growing evidence, and this study also reiterates that there are certain types of fats that are not that good, namely from processed meats. So they're naming bacon specifically because I think that's probably the most common one in the American diet. But that healthy fats and things like nuts and fish are really, really helpful for our health.
Yeah, I have got a good friend, someone I used to work with who's a provider, a physician, and each time new research comes out that really discusses some really potential problems with bacon, she says, don't take my bacon away. And yet she's like really one of the smartest I know. And it's not just bacon frequently, it's any processed meat. And then also it's the salt then. So, you know, these are sometimes highly salted foods, and salt more than 2,000 milligrams a day is really damaging. And I just found this really interesting. This was actually in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and looking at a government data on 700,000 deaths in 2012 from heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and then looking at those eating habits of people, and that 10 ingredients combined contributed to 45% of those deaths. And so there are the good ingredients. What were the good ingredients? Things you might expect?
Fruits, vegetables, nuts and seeds, whole grains, and then polyunsaturated fats, which are like vegetable oil, so your olive oil and seafood.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds like a Mediterranean diet. I kind of like that. But perhaps it's no different than what we've heard before, but perhaps maybe reemphasize this, That doesn't mean it's absolute. When they talk about red meat, they were talking about a weekly serving. But certainly if you had the red meat every single day, that moves into the realm where they're going to say it's a bad ingredient. I think we'll ask our health sciences librarians to post the table in this particular article that has those out there. We'd be interested in hearing your thoughts, perhaps not if you work for the fish industry, the vegetable industry, or the processed meat industry, but everyone else, we'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, and don't shy away from nuts just because they're a high-calorie item. I find a lot of people do that, and you do want to eat them in, you know, portion sizes, but they're really healthy.
Let's talk about our next research that matters, and it's about sleep and dementia. I think we hear so much about sleep, and I know that we talk about not getting enough sleep, but this suggests that too much sleep as a sign of potential dementia. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, I had not heard this before. But yeah, so seniors who begin to sleep more than 9 hours a night may be at a higher risk for dementia down the road. And it's not people who have always tended to be kind of heavier sleepers, but it's specifically new long sleepers.
Unfortunately, this article has no implications for treatment. But I do think it suggests that if you've seen a change in more sleeping, we don't want you to go wake people up thinking that's going to help them, because there's no evidence of that. But
it might be a warning sign that you might kind of talk to your doctor about what's going on, especially if you notice other cognitive changes.
Let's talk about our last research that matter, and it's about names and names that relate to one's face. And this is research that was in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Research came out of Israel. And they were looking at, does your name, such as Laurel?
Mm-hmm. Or Adam.
Or Adam. What would Laurel mean to you?
Ooh.
Smiling, brightness, laughing, like mountain Laurel. That's the image. And,
yeah,
and Adam would
that
mean.
That is indeed what I'm named after.
And
so
Adam would
it
mean.
Worked.
Yeah, so you look like the Laurel. So the research
That's
works.
That's why I got to be almost 6 feet tall because of the tree.
Because of the mountain there. It's interesting. And they were really looking at a test where they would give people a choice and, you know, names with characteristics and a 1 out of 5 chance. But they said people could pick the name 30% of the time, but it was only country specific. So the people in Israel couldn't pick out the French sounding name with the characteristics that, you know. I don't know about this, Laurel. This seemed interesting, but I'm not sure I think it tells us much. What do you think?
I agree. I'm not sure I would write home about it.
Yeah, we do think it's kind of interesting. The lead author was named Yonat, and I was thinking, okay, well, I wouldn't necessarily know it, you know, again, in country specific. But it does, you know, when someone's born, you do give a name that you think is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And so perhaps
and often has a lot of meaning.
It has a lot of meaning. But some names, you know, may not have that meaning. I mean, if you named your son Benjamin and was named after one of the people in the Bible, did you do that with the idea that this was going to be a biblical, you know, or a leader or, you know, I don't know. We all hope our children might be leaders, I guess. I did think, though, of about a poem that I had heard a long time ago by an Israeli poet named Zelda called Each of Us Has a Name. Have you heard of that poem?
No.
You haven't?
Mm-mm.
I'm going to read you 2 stanzas at the beginning and 2 stanzas at the end, because I think this
all
is
right.
I do think having a name really is much more, that it's not the name per se of what people see the characteristics, but it's the name of what we do in life and how that name goes forward. And I really did like this particular poem. Here it is. Each of us has a name given by God and given by our parents, given by our stature and our smile and given by what we wear, given by the mountains and given by our walls and given by the stars and given by our neighbors. Given by our sins and given by our longing. Each of us has a name given by our enemies and given by our love, given by our celebrations and given by our work, given by the seasons and given by our blindness. Each of us has a name given by the sea and given by our death. That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show, but we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Nathaniel Morris, a resident psychiatrist at Stanford University Medical School, about new narratives in the field of medicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. Today on Conversations, Laurel, we're talking with Dr. Nathaniel Morris, a resident in psychiatry at Stanford University Medical School, about new narratives in the field of mental health. Welcome, Dr. Morris.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your story, your narrative, of how you got interested in medicine and now in the field of psychiatry.
You know, everybody's got their own path into their specific specialties within medicine. And so my path, at least, it began, you know, I was always interested in neurobiology, neuroscience, you know, the science of the brain. And in college, I had done, you know, pretty, you know, basic science research. We were working with rats. We were, you know, measuring spikes in, you know, neurons. And, you know, I you know, had a thoughts of, you know, I think being a physician would be a pretty compelling career. I went to medical school. And then, you know, when I was in medical school, I had initially, along with those basic science inklings, had thought, okay, maybe I'll be a neurologist or a neurosurgeon or something like that. But what really drew me to psychiatry over time was really the patient's stories. And as I mentioned, everybody gets to specialties in different ways. You know, some surgeons just absolutely are captivated by the operating room, or some emergency physicians love the undifferentiated patient, somebody who walks into the door and you can, you know, figure out what's going on no matter what. And in psychiatry, for me at least, was really what drew me most to people's charts when I would have patients or new patients who I'd be picking up as a medical student or taking care of. And really just those stories in the charts of, you know, what leads to somebody to try to take their own life, or how do people get better, right, with certain medications. And over time, you know, I think everybody finds what draws them to a patient's chart, right? And for me, at least, it was those histories of mental illness or recovery, or, you know, all those different things that really are captivating within psychiatry.
Some really interesting questions there that drew you into this field. You write quite a lot generally about mental health and psychiatry, not just in academic journal articles, but also, you know, in things like Scientific American and other more layman's journals. So why do you think it's important to have these discussions kind of in the general public outside of the academic world?
I think that's an important question, because I think in medicine, a lot of the academic totem pole of people becoming assistant or associate professor or full professors or deans or whatever, you know, is they're publishing in academic journals and they're writing case reports. And those are incredibly important, right? Like, that's where most medical discoveries and, you know, how medicine advances itself. But psychiatry in particular, I think it's really important to branch out of that, because, one, the average person is not picking up the New England Journal of Medicine every afternoon and reading its headline. Most people don't know what JAMA is. And so having these conversations in the public, I think, is really important, and especially in psychiatry, where there's so much stigma, there's so much misunderstanding about the field itself. I think if we just isolate ourselves to the Journal of Psychiatry or, you know, whatever, then we'll really be missing a large portion of the population, not only in terms of their own understanding, but also in terms of patients and people who could be getting the help that they need, or people who could become providers, but they don't know enough about the field.
You know, it's really interesting. You wrote this, as Laurel just mentioned, this fascinating article for Scientific American. That's how I think we came aware of some of your thoughts about this, about mental health in a test tube. And in it, you're discussing that the purview of psychiatry has largely remained limited to diseases that defy explanation. And I guess the concern that the specialty of psychiatry is relegated to the medicine of the unknown. What do you mean?
Yeah, so that, you know, stems out of, I had this fascinating conversation in medical school with one of my psychiatry professors back when I was, you know, really beginning to think, hey, I think this is what I might go into. And I had that same thought that so many other people have about mental health and mental illness, and saying, hey, if you can't test for it, how do you know it's real, right? You know, how do you know that somebody's not making this stuff up? And the most fascinating thing that this professor had told me is, I say, hey, you know, so much of mental illness is absolutely, you know, it's completely bogus that we don't have tests for mental illness. We absolutely do, but the moment we develop a test, it's no longer considered mental illness. And so, you know, certain examples I think I'd listed in that article include somebody who's walking funny and they had an ulcer on their genitals and they're confused and they're having delusions. And, you know, years later, and this is in medicine, a classic presentation for neurosyphilis, and tons of, you know, any student studying for step one or step two knows that. And you treat it with penicillin and hopefully, you know, the person might get better. And that we can send blood tests. We can send cerebrospinal fluid tests, you know, for neurosyphilis. That is a condition that used to be relegated. People would go to asylum, and now that's treatable. Thyroid disease, another one, right, is, you know, I think I said in the article, if somebody is a college student and they come in and they're having palpitations, or sorry, their heart's beating really quickly, they're feeling super anxious all the time, you don't just say, oh, this person's got an anxiety disorder. You would send off a thyroid-stimulating hormone. You would test that in the person's blood, and that's something you can diagnose. Oh, this person might have hyperthyroidism, which is leading to anxiety. There are tons of examples of different diseases that in the past often were treated as psychiatric illness, but we've developed tests that we can test these things. But the real interesting part about it is, let's say you were somebody who had really, really bad anxiety. You're seeing a therapist or you're seeing a psychiatrist. You know, once that psychiatrist figures out, hey, let's send off this thyroid study, and it comes back positive, you may or may not continue seeing that psychiatrist, right? You get treated with levothyroxine or some medication, and oftentimes people then just end up being referred back to their primary care provider. So that's where I meant, like, outside the purview of psychiatry is oftentimes, hey, then it gets taken over by the other specialties. So it's this really, really interesting push and pull where we simultaneously really, really, you know, it's a captivating field where we want to discover the causes for schizophrenia and depression and bipolar disorder. But as we do that, it keeps on, you know, they kind of leave the field of psychiatry.
Isn't psychiatry dependent upon really making a concrete diagnosis? I think you used the example of the diagnostics manual where you actually lay out criteria. You can ask 9 questions and you can diagnose with really great degree of certainty whether or not someone's depressed. And same with anxiety. So isn't psychiatry really built around making those diagnoses already? And isn't that the science?
Yes and no. And so I think, you know, one thing that I wanted to take away from that article that I wrote about mental illness in a test tube is I don't think when I say other specialties, you know, or like these diseases leave the purview of psychiatry, I don't mean that completely, because I think at the end of the day, you know, mental health psychiatry is within medicine, and really to have good mental health care is having psychiatrists, having doctors who can recognize these overlaps, right, and who can test and diagnose both these things. And I think that the DSM and how we diagnose mental illness, sure, there's research backing up some of these symptoms. You know, we've trying to get some degree of inter-rater reliability where the same people will say, yes, this person has this disease based on certain criteria, but there's still some pretty big holes in there, right? Like one of the big ones that people have pointed to is that we think about all the different symptoms of depression that we diagnose people with. And so you can end up diagnosing 2 different people with depression and they have completely different symptoms, right? You know, one person is lying in bed all day and they're completely sad all the time and they're, you know, not eating, whereas the other person might be up all night and they're very anxious and they're suicidal. And so, you know, we might have very different presentations, but they end up getting the same diagnosis. And so I think the DSM's made important strides in having those criteria and having those objective standards across different providers, but there's still a long way to go. And, you know, that article I really focused on as well is developing some of the even more objective tests of blood draws or imaging or things like that.
I think it's a really interesting argument you're making for, you know, as things are in the realm of the unknown, it stays with psychiatry. And then as soon as there are more concrete tests, it kind of leaves psychiatry. I wonder if you would propose some sort of alternate model, or if, in fact, it also sometimes goes the other way and maybe that's not so good either. So things that are kind of solidly in the realm of physical illness when really they have strong mental health components, things like diabetes, hypertension, where we know that chronic stress plays a big role. I guess, but yeah, my question is, does it go both ways? And then and what do you envision about how treatment should be?
No, I totally agree. And as I mentioned, I think the ultimate message should not be to wall off other specialties of medicine for mental health and vice versa, right? And so I think you bring up a great point. It could go the same the other way, right, where somebody comes in and maybe they're having chest tightness and they have a tiny bit of findings on their electrocardiogram, or they have, you know, high cholesterol or something, and then, oh, suddenly we have a physical finding. So all we do is point to that, and we maybe ignore some of the anxiety or some of the depression that might be contributing to those symptoms, right? And so, I totally agree. I think that there's a tendency in, you know, mental health, as soon as you find a distinct physical cause, to say, okay, this is what's happening. But yeah, it really does go both ways. And it's really hard, and this aspect of the purview of the unknown, where you see a lot of conditions where tons of patients who have chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia, or even patients who say they have chronic Lyme disease or things like that, and where the, you know, a lot of the internal medicine doctors might not be able to find a specific lab test cause for that. And a lot of the times those patients do end up in the mental health field. So there is kind of this void in between the two fields that I think, as we're developing more tests, more reliable studies, you know, hopefully that void gets smaller and smaller, and we just see more overlap between the fields.
From your mouth to God's ears. But we're going to need to take a short break. And when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Nathaniel Morris, a resident psychiatrist at the Stanford University Medical School, about new narratives in the field of mental health. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. We've been talking with Dr. Nathaniel Morris, a resident psychiatrist at Stanford University Medical School, about new narratives in the field of mental health. And Dr. Morris, right before the break, you gave us a nice example of, you know, someone comes into the emergency room and they may have anxiety and depression, but they came in with chest pain and just a little something abnormal physically. And it's like, oh, that's got to be the cause of it. When reality is, a lot of those patients actually, it's anxiety and chest pain. And I wonder, we seem to be so good at saying what someone has when it's a physical problem, but we're reluctant to really go into it and say, anxiety and depression is causing this both statistically and in this case a lot. And so it seems to me we miss making diagnoses. And we just send it back over to the realm. And by the way, primary care has just a larger realm of unknown as psychiatry. We live in that realm. Yeah. We have to thrive in that realm. As a matter of fact, you probably don't go into that field unless you're comfortable. But what do you do? Do we need to get our colleagues to be better at this? What do we do?
If I had the answer, maybe I'd be done with residency. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure you're going to find it that quickly.
Yeah. It's a really hard question, right? As you go through medical school and training, you learn that the uncertainty of diagnosis is far more than the certainty of diagnosis in basically any case you see or any patient. And so in the emergency room, especially, or even in primary care clinics, it's really hard. I think what's really, really hard about it is trying, especially time-wise, can be a big constraint, especially in mental health, too, because as you mentioned, it can be reassuring to rule out the red flag causes, right? Somebody comes in with chest tightness and, you know, we're terrified that this person's having a heart attack, they're having a pulmonary embolism, they're having an aortic dissection. So we can do pretty rapid things to rule out a lot of those. We can, you know, send off an EKG, we can get a chest x-ray, we can, you know, get a CT of their chest or their abdomen. You know, all of those things can be done in matters of minutes to, you know, within hours or whatever, if you're sending off, you know, troponin enzymes. And it's really reassuring to see some of that. And I think it gets really hard in mental health, particularly one, because a lot of it takes, there's a lot of time investment in terms of longitudinal care for people, seeing over time how they do. But two is sometimes you can't have that number that you can look at just to look back and see how they're doing, right? Is you have a patient who comes in and their troponin's elevated, and then you check again in X number of hours, and now it's going down. You're saying, okay, maybe things are getting better, or that's reassuring. And a lot of the times in mental health, it depends on how the patient's feeling, which is really hard. And I think it's not just mental health, though, because as you mentioned, you know, especially in emergency department, like, pain is a big one, too. Like, how do physicians deal with pain? That's one of the biggest issues that people have to deal with over time. And so I think there really is this push and pull. We want to rule out the scariest things, but does that mean we're doing a service to the chronic things or the things that are there right in front of us, but that might not be as easy to test for?
Yeah, I think too about the patient experience and being told, no, you're not having, there's no physical cause of your chest pain, you just are having a panic attack, and how kind of often disappointing that feels. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about the kind of stigma that goes into that, and perhaps how we could maybe deliver that news in a way that doesn't make patients feel so guilty.
Yeah, I think that's a huge, huge thing. And I've seen it all the time during residency so far is the biggest sentence people will say is, so you're telling me it's all in my head.
Right.
Which, I mean, technically, yes, but like the body, that's basically, if you agree with that saying, then you're saying that the body's not connected, the brain's not connected to the rest of the body, right? I mean,
there's a lot going on in the brain.
Yeah, it's like if you came in and I said you had a heart attack and somebody said, so you're just telling me it's all in my heart. Well, yeah, part of it is part in your heart. And so it's really hard. And anytime you get that, it's hard because you have to think about what that patient's going through too. Just as you mentioned, they're coming in, it's terrifying, their heart's pounding, they feel like they're going to die, and you just say the equivalent of, you know, yeah, you're feeling anxious, right? You're having a panic attack or something. And so I actually just finished a neurology rotation, and one of the biggest things we saw in this was when people are having, you know, seizure-like episodes, but then they get hooked up to electroencephalograms, and there's no seizure activity to correlate with that. So that's often called psychogenic non-epileptic seizures or spells. And so that's a really, really tricky one, too, where you have to tell a patient who's having these seizure-like events, you're not having actual electroencephalographic seizures, but you talk through to them. And I've seen physicians who do a really, really great job of explaining, you know, hey, the connection between the body and the mind is profound. It can cause ulcers, it can cause high blood pressure, it can cause all of these different things. And, you know, yeah, sometimes it can cause seizure-like events, or it can cause these panic attacks too. And I think really normalizing the experience and saying, hey, you're not the only person who's ever gone through this. This is very, very common, and also in many cases treatable, can be really comforting and really helpful for some patients.
You've also really written some interesting things about the experience of providers with mental health. And, you know, I know you're in an internship and in a residency, and that's a very difficult and stressful time in one's life. Why is this issue important to you, provider mental health? Maybe it's obvious to everyone that your provider, if they're not healthy, it's hard to deliver good care, but it's not just that, is it?
No. I mean, it's one of the biggest issues in medicine right now is physician burnout, physician depression. You know, I was pretty open about it during medical school, writing some articles about how when I was as a like third year medical student going through an episode of depression and being open about that and seeking care for it. I mean, it was pretty scary having to open up and think, okay, is this going to affect my medical license? Are patients going to look at me differently? Am I, you know, not going to get into a residency program? And really, I think the biggest either paradox or, you know, most unique thing about it is I'm thinking, I'm in healthcare, right? I'm becoming a doctor, and now I'm becoming somebody who's specializing in mental health and being terrified to open up about your own mental health. I mean, if that doesn't say something, you know, the fact that the caregivers can't even care for themselves or can't even be open about it, you know, what does that say for everybody else? And so I think it's really pretty scary that so many physicians out there, you know, it's a really hard job. It gets you down after time. The hours can be so long. And so for those people who spend their days caring for other people to not be able to care for themselves, I think it's really tough. And I think it's fortunately becoming something that's more talked about and it's more open. And I think it's becoming more of an issue that people are recognizing. But I still think it is a huge issue in and of itself that we have so many physicians who people dedicate their lives to helping other people, but we make the job so difficult or it is so difficult that, you know, they often want to drop out, burn out, or even in many cases, physicians who end up killing themselves and getting to that end point. And so raising the question of how can we have a more open conversation about it? How can we make it so that physicians or medical students are more willing to talk about these issues or getting the care that they need?
Yeah, I had a friend the other day was asking about a condition. I said, well, you know, you need to see your primary care physician. And they kind of got blank looked. And I asked, well, you don't have a primary care physician? They said, no, my primary care physician killed themselves last year. And that just is, there's a level of sadness there that's just overwhelming.
Yeah. Yeah. So all these narratives we've talked about, stigma and doctors having issues with depression and other mental health issues, how can we help our patients kind of navigate all of these different, perhaps false or misguiding narratives about psychiatry and mental health?
My biggest thing is, you know, I think the more we talk about these issues, I think the less scary they become. So it's, you know, as a provider, you do the most you can, right, to advocate for your patients. You say, hey, you know, this person, you know, really needs that appointment, or you speak up for mental health, or you know, educate other providers about, you know, mental health conditions. Talking to patients, it's part of the challenge too, overcoming that stigma, because I can't even count the number of patients who say they don't want to have that appointment because they don't want to be seen walking into the mental health part of the hospital. Or even, you know, when, you know, I'll be on call and psychiatry gets consulted and you show up, And the patient's furious and says, who told you that you could come and talk to me? You know, I don't want to talk to a psychiatrist. And you have to talk to that person. I think rather than getting frustrated and saying, okay, fine, I'm not going to help you, instead you say, you know, where does that perception come from? You know, why are you not interested in talking about mental health? And so my approach to it has always been openness about these conditions. And, you know, I think the more open we are, the more we're going to help not only providers, as we've talked about, who clearly are in need of help, but also our own patients.
I think that you're wise beyond your years. Sounds like you're doing some great things to help others around the country relate more in the doctor-patient relationship. We want to congratulate you and wish you really well.
That's very nice of you guys. Pleasure chatting.
We've been talking with Dr. Nathaniel Mars, a resident psychiatrist at Stanford University Medical School, about new narratives in the field of mental health. I want to thank him so much for being our guest on Your Health. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, Laurel, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listeners' health questions and concerns. And if they have a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question.
I've had trouble quitting smoking, and a friend recommended that I try hypnosis. Does that really work?
Well, we've got one of the experts here in counseling patients about smoking cessation. And Laurel, I'm going to say you're listening to my voice. Look at my finger here. No. Hypnotherapy is an established modality of treatment that works for lots of conditions. Does it work for smoking cessation?
If I were talking to this person directly, I would say it does for some people. I've heard that anecdotally. I don't feel confident in the research supporting it as a evidence-based practice. So I always encourage people to use the things that we really do know work and work for the vast majority of people. So that would be FDA-approved tobacco cessation medications, which is nicotine replacement, Chantix or varenicline, and Wellbutrin or bupropion, and then counseling. So those two, the combination of medications and then getting some sort of support counseling through a quit line or from a local counseling group that does tobacco treatment. That'd be my suggestion. And then if for some reason the rare person they've tried everything and nothing works, go for it. Try hypnosis.
Yeah, the issue is that I think sometimes people think that something else alone may work. So if someone were doing hypnosis, which unfortunately the research has not panned out significantly, there needs to be more research, it should be hypnosis plus medication plus counseling therapies. It's not then I'm going to do the hypnosis and try to leave that alone, because we know that the behavioral therapies, double quit rates, the medications double quit rates, and those things combined can up to triple quit rates. So I think you're absolutely right. It's stay with the established therapies, but we're doing everything we can to help people quit. It's really hard because even under the best of circumstances, 7 out of 10 may not be able to quit in that first year after they've really made a serious quit attempt. So we do need more research.
Also, hypnosis is not cheap. I've heard from most people it's like $300 or $400. So if you're spending that much money, spend it on something that we have a little bit more firm grounding that's going to be effective.
Great advice. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My husband and I are in our 40s, and we've been trying to lose weight together. We've realized that he loses weight much faster than I do. How can we be successful together when we lose weight at such different rates, and how do I keep from getting discouraged?
Well, can you just attribute the weight loss to both of you? Just
if you lost 10
pounds and he lost 2 pounds, just say we lost on average 5 pounds each.
There you go.
I don't think that's going to work. That's not going to work, is it, Laura?
Oh, man, no. This is a good question because it comes up a lot. And it is true that particularly as we get older, men tend to lose weight a little bit. I don't want to say easier, but more likely to lose weight quicker.
Why is that?
You know what? People ask me that all the time. I don't have a good answer for it yet. It has something to do with metabolism and hormones. It's usually my answer.
So what advice do you give?
So I would say that the best thing to do, you mentioned getting frustrated, and that's a common issue with weight loss. So I would set your own individual goals and focus on a really small chunk, whether it's 5 pounds, 10 pounds, nothing more than that at the start. And then not just a weight goal, but make some specific action-oriented goals. So things like, what can you actually do? Am I going to try to get 2 servings of vegetables a day? Am I going to try to cut my calories by 250 calories a day? Some really specific action-oriented things. And that way, as long as you're both doing those things, you can feel good about it and focus a little bit less on the number. That hopefully will follow. But that's the advice that we give to people. And it's a little bit of a reframing of how you're thinking about the issue.
And Laurel runs the weight management program at the University of North Carolina. Any of our listeners interested, I'm certain that program could really be of benefit if you're in the local region. But we'll put up some tips for successfully losing weight that we can recommend, because this is a really important. And congratulations that both of you are trying together. What a great thing.
Yeah, it is wonderful. And Laura, it helps to have support.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
Our 27-year-old daughter has been suffering from anxiety and depression, and she recently underwent surgery for carpal tunnel syndrome. She's been in a lot of pain, and her orthopedist says it's a complex regional pain syndrome and wants her to see a regional pain specialist. What do you think?
Oy. This is difficult. This is really difficult. And first off, we're sorry about the surgery, and on top of the difficulties with mental health and then throwing in pain, this is not easy.
Yeah, it's not. And it's a combination that often goes together too.
This complex regional pain syndrome is something that affects not just one nerve, but it can affect a whole bunch of nerves, and it results in perceptions of pain that are way out of proportion to what you may see physically, particularly early on. So someone, you know, had surgery, they maybe have a cast on or something on their arm, and maybe what they were treating before wasn't too painful, and then the surgery should have relieved it, but then they start getting pain far worse than perhaps what they initially had, and you think, oh, maybe the cast is too tight. And then somewhere along the line, one starts to realize that there's nothing that you see physically going on, and you may have done some x-rays, didn't see anything. And you think, oh, this is that complex regional pain syndrome. It used to be called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, RSD. It's one of the things that doctors fear, and I bet patients fear even more, because it is really painful, and it can last for a good long time. I know, Laurel, you have some concerns about the types of drugs that perhaps could be treated or how providers may think about this sometimes.
Yeah, well, I mean, first off, I would say that it can be really hard to get that diagnosis and to really give yourself some space to just grieve that, the fact that it is a real issue and there's not a physical cause going on, and just that is really frustrating. But there is treatment, which Adam's going to talk about in a second. But I would just be wary of using some of the pain medications that are out there, because this is your daughter might be somebody who's particularly at risk for becoming dependent on things like opioids or narcotics. And then to also be aware that people in the healthcare profession might be viewing your daughter in that way, that she, people might view her as a terrible label that I don't like to use, but a kind of drug-seeking patient if she were to present asking for pain medicine. And that's just a really complicated issue right now.
Yeah, I think, first off, sometimes you can prevent these things. So if someone's had a distal limb surgery, and they maybe have some risk for developing this, vitamin C as a preventive therapy for a month or two can actually be, 500 milligrams, not a large dose, can be effective. Physical therapy and occupational therapy, getting this person involved and engaged with those types of therapists that really can help mobilize, because what happens is it doesn't get used and then it atrophies, and then that makes things worse, as we know, when you're not using your limbs. This person may need psychological help with the anxiety and depression. They probably, if they don't have a therapist, they need a therapist, because they're going to need a lot of support.
It might get worse with the pain, that those things all kind of fuel each other.
Absolutely. And then in terms of medications, usually starting with a non-opiate medication like ibuprofen or naproxen, sometimes prescription medicines like gabapentin, also called Neurontin, amitriptyline, also known as Elavil. These are some of the things that would be common way before going to things like an opiate, which would be really not first, second, or even third choice in this particular circumstance.
Probably not helpful.
Yeah. No. Well, listen, we really hope that you can get in. The specialist will be important, working with your primary care doctor to help coordinate. This is an interdisciplinary and collaborative effort, but I would be aggressive and advocate, as you are doing. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of our listeners today for sending in excellent questions and tuning into your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can share anything you want to, any question, email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or look for our health app. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Nathaniel Morris. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Laurel Sisler.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.